Hello and welcome to episode 7 of High and Low, a Kurosawa podcast with me, your host as usual, Spencer, and Joel's here again.
Yep, can't get rid of me. Although you did get rid of me that one episode, but this time we got backup too.
That's true. So, I think there's a third person here.
Oh, yes. I mean,
hey guys. I just appeared from around the door frame. Bow, 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 bow. It's me. Wearing an oversized Hawaiian shirt.
It's
very appropriate. This was a very Hawaiian movie. Wait, what movie?
Nothing's more flattering than comparing oneself to Michael Richards' character.
The racist?
Right, guys? Right? Guys?
Who are you and what are you doing here?
That's a very good question. From that super strange improv that your listeners are very right to wonder. Hi, my name is Shannon Camp. I'm a friend, acquaintance, internet pal of the guys, and I do a podcast called Stage of Fools, which is about the e-television network's attempt to modernize Shakespeare's Hamlet and turn it into, like, what my mother calls a sexcapade. So it's a little bit Shakespeare, it's a little bit garbage. It's a perfect fit.
My mother also watches the Royals. Yeah, I saw her watching it a couple days ago.
Well, tell her about the podcast.
I don't think she knows what a podcast is. Well, she does, but she doesn't understand how to download them.
That's what you are supposed take the reins on that there, Spencer. It's not...
Nah, I don't want to get her started. It'll be...
I mean, don't force her to listen to your stuff, but, you know...
No, they won't care anyways.
Well, even if she's not into podcasts, just have her pick up the phone and call me, because I would love to just talk about it. Honestly, it's been such a dark time in my life, in all of our lives, that I've really let myself disappear into the mind-numbingly stupid politics of this alternative universe where time has no meaning, and it's just... It's a show where people don't act like people and things don't work like things work, but I find it kind of comfortingly sweet.
And it's based off of Hamlet, much like the movie for this episode, the what's it called?
The Bad Sleep Well.
Bad Sleep Well, and that's where the similarities...
Oh. Yeah, like I know that it says that on the Wikipedia article and on IMDb, but it would have to be like one of those credits that says inspired by, not actually based on. Because other than a kind of revenge plot, I mean, Shannon would know better when we get into it.
Yeah, my Shakespeare knowledge is... I read Hamlet for literature class in college, and I really liked it because my teacher, his favorite piece of writing was Hamlet. He felt that was the best piece of writing anyone can read, and he made me excited about it. And that's kind of...
Well, I'll give a little bit of background as to my Shakespeare experience so that your listeners understand, like, why the hell I'm here. I became really enamored with Shakespeare's works when I was in the sixth grade, and I read A Midsummer Night's Dream in my literature class and started attending Shakespeare plays at Chicago Shakespeare Theater here on Navy Pier. And when I studied acting in college, my program had a pretty intense Shakespeare focus, and then I intensified that even further by going overseas and studying Shakespeare at Royal Holloway University of London in England. And I made my professional debut as an actor playing Viola in Twelfth Night. So, yeah, I've never been in Hamlet, but I do have a good amount of Shakespeare background, both from a study and performance perspective. And I will say, Hamlet is not one of my personal favorite Shakespeare plays because I don't feel particularly strongly about any of the characters. Like, I don't seethe with hate over Claudius the way I might over, I don't know, the villain of Measure for Measure. And I don't really, like, love Ophelia the way I love Desdemona from Othello or something like that. But I think one of the things that is really strong about Hamlet and one of the reasons it's endured is because it has so many different themes and ideas inside of it, and it can be interpreted so many different ways that there are pretty much endless versions, endless adaptations you could do, kind of riffing on the ideas that, I mean, Shakespeare himself was cobbling together a story out of already tried and true fiction tropes of his era. So I won't even say that Shakespeare first presented himself. But, you know, Joel mentioned that this is a very loose adaptation of Hamlet, but I think that speaks both to the strength of this movie and to...
Oh, yeah. I've heard of Hamlet before. Is this where I come in and say what a Hamlet is?
Yeah, what's your experience with Shakespeare?
Well, obviously, I had to read it in high school. I've been in productions of Shakespeare plays, although other than Midsummer Night's Dream, I can't really remember other ones. But, you know, outside of high school, I haven't been going crazy over Shakespeare. I'm sorry, hold on a sec. What?
Yeah, okay.
Much Ado About Nothing. Okay, that's another one I was in. Sorry, my girl. But, you know, I've seen a few movie adaptations, but I'm not crazy about
Hamlet.
Shakespeare necessarily. Like, I would love to see theatrical productions of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. I'm not too crazy about movie productions. I'm not too crazy about special adaptations. Ethan Hawke, put the camcorder down.
There have been... I actually talked about this on Alcohollywood on Monday, because we did an episode on Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet.
All right.
Anyway, what I was going to say was that we were talking... I was talking with Clint and also his girlfriend, Julia, who runs a theater company. And she and I are both big theater people. I'm sure that, like me, she's seen many a Shakespeare play put on the stage. And we agreed there really are very few good Shakespeare films that are like straight versions of his work put to film. Like, even movies like the Lawrence Fishburne, Kenneth Branagh Othello that have a really great cast often suffer from really poor direction because film directors' method doesn't translate to Shakespeare, or they bring in a stage director to do the Shakespeare stuff who has no idea how to do film. And so it is rare when those elements gel, which is why I think I actually tend to gravitate more towards films like this one that don't actually use Shakespeare's words, which I really can't recommend highly enough, seeing a Shakespeare play on stage if you get the chance, you know, at a company where you like the work that they do. But on film, I do think I prefer these versions that dispose of his actual text and kind of forge their own path.
Yeah, I think with Bad Sleep, it would be weird seeing it translated to Japanese, like this old English to Japanese. I don't think would make much sense, maybe.
I mean, you can combine cultural elements in surprising ways. I was in a version of A Midsummer Night's Dream that was directed by a couple from Bali, Indonesia. They used like all Indonesian mask work and body movement and stuff, and kind of put different. I mean, I'm not going to go into detail of all the things we changed because that's another story for another podcast. But I do think there can be interesting fusion between Asian culture and old English of the Shakespearean era. But this is just not what that film is. I mean, first of all, the story is hugely divergent from Hamlet. Hugely divergent. It's more of a riff on the themes in Hamlet than even the characters per se. So I don't know how incorporating Shakespeare's original text would serve the story in any respect.
Interesting. Like I barely remember reading Hamlet in college. So to me, I always thought of that like, oh, it's this Kurosawa doing Hamlet. And now,
oh no. No. Hmm. It barely bears any similarity to Hamlet. It's more of a play on the themes of Hamlet. Most of the characters from Hamlet are absent and a bunch of new characters are added. I mean, there is very few analogous parts of the story. I would love to get into what those analogous parts are, but I don't know if you can, like, tell everyone the summary of what happened, or I don't know how you guys would like to do things.
Joel, do you want to do a summary?
Yeah, let's get into that. Feel free to interrupt anytime you want to add something here.
Sure. Should I jump in with when there are...
Absolutely. I'm just going to take this...
Because it would be way easier to point out similarities than point out differences. If I'm pointing out differences, I'll just...
No, right, then, let's do similarities, because...
Okay.
Let's start off with the differences. Okay, so his uncle doesn't marry his mother. Okay, so synopsis. Here we go. This movie starts off at a wedding. Bum, 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 bum. Okay, sorry.
And, a very Western wedding.
Yeah. I mean, I guess because they do play the wedding march in it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I was wondering how Japan nowadays handles weddings. I'm sure there's just a variety of different types of ceremonies.
The funeral also felt like a combination of Buddhist culture and Western Christianity, so I found that very interesting.
Yeah, any movie after the 40s is, you see so much of, you know, U.S. American culture has kind of bled into the Japanese culture, you know, starting with obviously the men moving from the traditional garb into these business suits, and for women it took a lot longer for them to start wearing dresses like Americans were, but there was a whole bunch of things that just subtly got changed as they realized they could make money if they were more similar to the businessmen and military people that were spending time there.
Yep.
Yoshiko, I think is the name of the bride, when Yoshiko first came in, I actually didn't realize that her character was supposed to be lame or crippled. I mean, gosh, what's the disabled? Those are the words they use in the film, are lame and crippled. When they're having a conversation about it later on, because I thought that perhaps it had something to do with either special footwear or, foot binding of some kind. Although I guess
I was confused with that too. I thought she was.
Wow, I'm just revealing all the different flavors of.
No,
my
I had the same reaction. I thought it was just like a weird style of shoes. I didn't know she was like disabled until.
Yeah, it looked like she was wearing very difficult to move in platform shoes. So I
one of her shoes was had a much larger sole, and so I think that she literally was handicapped in a way that one of her legs was shorter than the other, which is why she has such a difficult time moving and has to have somebody walking by, and they.
Is this an adaptation of a Shakespeare play or a Tennessee Williams play? Am
Who's
I right,
Tennessee
guys?
Williams? No, I'm just kidding. I don't.
Theater jokes. Oh. No, I don't actually see an influence here. I was just making a dumb leg brace joke, like the sensitive person I am.
So I would have made
17 adaptations. So the interesting thing about this wedding is that there are tons of reporters that are waiting in the lobby. You know, they're being kind of polite. I mean, they're obviously just waiting to mug and take pictures of these important people because it's a wedding for people who, I mean, the vice president's daughter is getting married to his personal secretary. So the players at this point are Yoshiko, who is the bride. We have Nishi, who is the groom. And then, of course, Iwabuchi. See, I can't even say it right. Iwabuchi is the vice president. He seems to be the elder of the situation there. Everyone is bowing to him and listening to whatever he has to say. There is also Shirai, who has to take over the master of ceremonies position when poor Wada, who is, what is he? What is his position?
He's deputy, deputy chief of contracts.
He's assistant to the chief, according to.
Okay, there we go. Oh, yeah.
Which I have.
Me too. Anyways, Wada is suddenly arrested, along with another person whose name I've drawn a blank on.
I think Itakuru.
His name starts with an M. Itakuru is the other. Nishi.
That's,
Moriyama. Well, I wanted to interject here quickly. Because in addition to Yoshiko and her father, Vice President Iwabuchi, there's also the younger Iwabuchi, the kind of like a son who doesn't have a job and hasn't really done anything with his life, but he's kind of just
and
a
rich
layabout. Here with this sort of triangle of characters is where we actually see the first resemblance to Hamlet, because even though I think Vice President Iwabuchi is more the Claudius of this story, he can kind of also be the Polonius in this role. And Polonius has two children, his son Laertes, who is a student, which is something that throughout Hamlet, it's made kind of clear that it's not something that's necessarily looked upon as like the most important thing in the world that you could be doing. And also Laertes maybe isn't the most dedicated student. And then, of course, you have Ophelia, the daughter, who is younger. She's not disabled like this character is, but she's definitely more meek and mild-mannered and dependent on her father and brother. I mean, as would have been the custom in Ophelia's time as well as this character's time. So here we've got a little bit of Hamlet's
there. We go. So, so Wada and Miura is the name of the other person who gets arrested. And this kind of happens unceremoniously. There's not a big deal made about it because I guess they don't want to interrupt the wedding. Please just come and grab these two guys. The reporters are like, okay, that's weird. And the ceremony gets on with some toasts. They bring out that wedding cake and another cake suddenly appears in the back, which is shaped like a 10-story building. It's actually very, very nice looking cake.
Yeah,
but there's a rose stuck on the 7th floor in a window.
And that upsets all the stuffy corporate guys.
This actually may be the biggest Hamlet similarity in the entire movie in terms of direct plot. And I know what you're thinking about a cake, but I'm serious. Because in Hamlet, Hamlet has this idea that he can prove his uncle's guilt to himself by, you know, restaging his father's murder as a play and then sitting in the audience and watching his uncle's reaction at the moment when this treacherous brother pours poison in the ear of the king to kill him. And Claudius does react by getting up and running out of the theater, which is like Hamlet's like, I've seen all I need to see. Take him away,
boys. I didn't do it.
But with this moment with the cake, it's not completely the same, obviously, but you have this interesting idea of a moment of performance that's sort of supposed to anonymously call out the villains and say, like, I'm on to you, I know what you did, but in a very oblique way. Although, a more oblique way than Hamlet's, for sure, which is restaging his father's murder exactly and then spinning around his chair and looking at Claudius.
This way is much more delicious.
Everybody gets a big old slice of that delicious cake, absolutely.
Do you think they actually made that cake?
Although, more expensive. Because those traveling players that Hamlet hired were probably working
this for came out of the 1.5 million yen that Nishi had in his budget for, you know, revenge. But they do actually call out they pretty blatantly call out who the evil people in this. They call them the cleanup trio because they had obvious some sort of embezzling bids done for something. I'm not exactly sure what they were bidding on.
It's like a business deal with a land development corporation.
Yeah. And so they get 12 billion yen for this when the other companies were only bidding up to 8.5 billion at the most. So why was there such a big difference? We will find out. Those cleanup trio, by the way, are Shirai, who is a very, very nervous person. Like, if we had to pick a Claudius' reaction, it's him practically, like you were saying, he was pulling at his collar. I didn't do it. Moriyama, who reacts, but not in an extreme way. He doesn't drop a knife. And Iwabuchi, who almost doesn't react at all.
Yeah. And Joel, who plays Moriyama?
Why, that would be my father, a.k.a. Takashi Shimura.
Yeah.
Wedding goes off, and we transition to... I believe they have a small conversation about what's going on, but they do a lot of transitions in this movie with newspaper articles being like... people arrested at wedding. This guy did something. This guy probably also did something. You know.
Yeah. You make an amazing journalist.
Hey.
This guy did something. This guy.
Corporate greed.
Also did something.
This just in. Donald Trump, he made people mad.
It's like that show from BoJack Horseman, Hollywood celebrities, what do they know? Do they know things? Let's find out.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at my job. Okay. So, we see the interrogation of... I believe we're seeing... we're seeing Wada being interrogated by the police. And they want him to admit that there has been some embezzlement going on, that there's something foul going on, and everyone knows it. Why won't you just tell? But these guys... Miura and Wada are absolutely stone cold about keeping what they know a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be released because of that. But when Miura is released, he immediately is... Well, they try to arrest him immediately because they have enough evidence to put him away on embezzlement charges. His lawyer takes him aside and tells him that Iwabuchi told him to tell him that he knows he will do what is necessary, which involves Mira jumping directly in front of a truck.
Yes, and here's another... potential Hamlet similarity. I'm guessing it's not accidental. So, as I mentioned, Claudius, who is Hamlet's treacherous uncle, if you're one of like the five people in the world who's not familiar with the general premise of Hamlet, Hamlet's treacherous uncle pours poison into the ear of the sleeping king, his elder brother, Hamlet's father, and kills him. So, obviously, in this movie, we don't have any literal poison, but we do have the idea of putting poison in someone's ear in a metaphorical way, talking them into killing themselves.
I like it. I like the reach.
It's a little more abstruse, but it's how a lot of the characters die, is being talked into killing themselves, and there's often a lot of shots of characters, you know, literally whispering into each other's ears. Sometimes the dialogue is unheard, and it's sort of
absolutely
running motif.
Yeah.
So, well, we've got one guy taken care of, but we're expecting Wada also to take care of his own situation, although he wasn't rearrested. But he's shown himself to be kind of a nervous character. When he was being interrogated, he was making these faces, although he was not talking. So Wada, I believe, decides to try to commit suicide by... I mean, was that a volcano?
It's a volcano.
Okay. Because, I mean, I...
So metal.
I see a bunch of steam rolling off the ground. Looks really dangerous.
And Nishi comes to save him.
That's correct. He puts on his cape, flies in.
Well, to save him, to use for his plan to get revenge.
Yeah. He saves him for his own purposes.
That's right. He's got a plan. Wada, he doesn't want Wada to kill himself for a very specific reason. So he takes him away from there. At this point,
Even though his motives are kind of oblique at this point, before we talk more about Nishi, I wanted to toss out there the potential idea that if Nishi is our Hamlet, which I think is definitely the case as we see the plot unfold, I sort of saw Wada and... God help me, Shirai, as sort of like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, because they were so distraught at times as to be almost comical. But more than that, Hamlet uses Rosencrantz and Guildenstern kind of, they're sort of his allies. He basically uses them until he needs to dispose of them, at which point he has them deliver a letter that is the orders for their own execution because they betrayed him. I sort of saw them, as the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern in that respect. Nishi, quote-unquote, saves them, you know, so that they can get revenge too, as he explains it to them, or at least to Wada. But he's also kind of, like... He's totally fine with destroying their mental health if it means, you know, getting closer to Hamlet.
Yeah, he's a real Batman.
And I mean, Shirai and Wada were probably my favorite characters in terms of, like, just enjoyment I got out of their scenes. So I really like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, too, although I will admit mostly because of the Tom Stoppard play that is based on them. I really liked their role in it all.
Absolutely. Wada, I think the actor who plays Wada is feeling a lot of shame. He feels like he should have thrown him off. And we see newspapers saying that he has committed suicide because he left a suicide note at the volcano. And they're obviously not going to recover his body from that. So everyone assumes that he's dead. This is working out great for...
I love that they checked the volcano for a suicide note, though. That's the first place I think.
It happens all the time, I'm sure. That's the worst part. At Wada and Nishi take a little field trip to Wada's funeral. And that's actually, I mean, you can feel how sad it is for Wada to see not only, I mean, there are people there to pay their respects, and the company, of course, has shelled out money for them because another way of admitting that they may be responsible for his death, but, you know, not really admitting it. But he sees his wife and his daughter, and they are mourning is lost. And at first, I think he wants to run out there and be like, I'm still alive, please, please stop, you know, or possibly go commit suicide because, hey, this funeral's really nice. I might as well earn it. But Nishi has a recording of, I believe it's Shirai and Mariyama, or
Mariyama? Yeah.
Thank you. Talking about how one of them convinced Wada very easily to end his life. And so he is now tied into the Nishi's revenge plot. Let's see.
Yes.
Yes, and of course, revenge is extremely central to Hamlet, to say the least. It's the driving force of the plot, if there is one, although one of the, you know, most ongoing critiques of Hamlet is that it's not really plot-driven at all. There's a lot of waffling, and to this day, there's a great deal of debate over whether Shakespeare's movements in that respect, with Hamlet going towards revenge and then away from it, are mistakes, or if they're an intentional commentary. But I was reading today, as I was watching this film, the idea of the revenge theme as being a religious crisis, because it's God's, if you're Christian or if you believe in, you know, this tenet, as Hamlet, the Hamlet characters would have, it's God's job to dole out like justice or punishment to sinners. But you also have the idea of familial duty. So it's also your responsibility to avenge your father's killer, and it creates this sort of conflict. And I think that kind of speaks to what Joel was talking about with this scene where he wants to run out and be like, I'm alive. And at the same time, he wants to kill himself. Like, the idea of the duality of there being two driving forces or two things that are quote unquote right to the character.
No, not at all. I was waiting for Spencer to say something. Spencer?
I don't know.
That's okay.
No, you didn't.
Off track there. I'm sorry. I just got excited.
No, that was great.
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. Someone to make us look stupid.
That's the problem. You're dumbfounding us. Stop it. Stop. No, I'm just kidding. That's fine. No, it's.
The one topic this is that what I we wanted. Shit about. God help
this
you.
Is great. So, and water, after we've got this revenge plot, we're going to take a first step towards revenge here. And that is to start with the weakest link of the three evil dudes, which is Shirai, obviously. The one who had the biggest reaction when that super fancy cake came out. And I should say that I have that same reaction whenever I see a super fancy cake, so I don't see what the big deal is. Exactly. I dropped the knife. I'm just so shocked by how beautiful it is. Shirai is in charge of moving some of the funds, which they're being secretive about where they're keeping this extra. Turns out to be 1.5 billion yen, and they've got it all over the place, and one of the places that they do have it is in a lockbox that only Shirai and Wada have access to. Or, so, if Wada's dead, that means only Shirai has access to it. Except, when Shirai goes to the bank to retrieve 15 million yen that is being stored there, he finds that the lockbox is empty. That makes you the number one suspect, man. And
but there's a line in this scene that is so amazing. They're talking about, like, after Shirai leaves, the others are talking about, like, why would he steal this small amount when his payout was already greater than that? And one of the characters says, like, when a man has had a full dinner, he's not hungry for a snack. And I'm like, have you met me?
It's exactly.
Like, I can think of plenty of occasions where I'm full, but I would still very much like to eat a snack. That is the worst metaphor of all time.
When a man is hungry, he no longer wants a gigantic cake. Actually, he does. It's, we know that about this. Yeah. But, shows. And, of course, Nishi, being the assistant to the vice president, is listening at the door. He grabs Shirai's briefcase and stuffs the money into there. Picks up his briefcase, or it's actually handed to him by Nishi, because at first they... Oh, Siri thinks I'm talking to him.
You'll need to unlock your iPhone.
Okay, hey Siri. Nice to talk to you. At first they ask Nishi to bring the bag in, but Shirai goes out and grabs it. Nishi hands him the bag. Shirai is looking through it furiously for the keys that he thinks he might have lost, and sees that he's got a whole crap load of yen in there. He freezes. He freezes long enough that Moriyama comes out and says, "What the hell's going on?" I was thinking about it. I think I probably would have walked back in and said, "It's in my bag, and I don't know how it got there. I didn't put it in there. Hmm. I think someone's screwing with us."
Well, Shirai... Oh.
Shirai is like the Uncle Billy of this Bailey building and loan.
I just lost the money. I don't know. Oh, man.
He's got ribbons tied on all his fingers. I can't find the Bailey. Knife.
That town. Okay. Don't want to go into that. I have opinions about George Bailey. So, naturally, I mean, I can't even remember what their conclusion is. Once Moriyama realizes that Shirai has the money in his briefcase, he takes it in, right? Like,
don't they hire an assassin to kill Shirai? Because he's like, draw me a map of where Shirai lives. And tell me about the street he lives on.
That's after he starts cracking up a bit more. So, Shirai does think that somebody's screwing with him, but he doesn't tell them that. Later, he's despondent. I think he goes and gets wasted or something like that.
Yeah, he gets
takes a taxi
drunk
back to his home. And as when he gets dropped off, it's this really nice shot of shadowy street, you know, only a few lights on. And into one of the lights in the distance, Wada suddenly steps out and just looks at him. And Shirai has the appropriate Three Stooges reaction of going, "Ooh!" You know?
Yeah.
And Wada is quickly picked up by a speeding car, so there's no way to prove that he just saw Wada. He's just cracking up as far as he knows. And
this is another one of the probably more obvious Hamlet parallels, because Hamlet has the ghost of old King Hamlet, Hamlet's father. Although there are moments in Hamlet where Hamlet and the ghost converse and his mother or someone will think that he's talking to no one and Hamlet is cracking up, lots of people see the ghost of old King Hamlet. Several guards, Hamlet's best friend Horatio. There's definitely, like, less of an assumption of insanity in that respect in Hamlet, but I really enjoyed this scene. Like I said before, I'm pretty sure Wada and Shirai were my favorite parts of the movie.
Oh, well, they do some great stuff with Shirai to show, especially like using the environment to show how freaked out he is and the lighting differences. There's a scene not too far from now when he is meeting with the other two JoJos, and when they open the door, he is just crouched in the corner, and it's this—he's center frame, crouched in the corner, kind of shot. Like you can see that he feels trapped, even in this private place that they're meeting up.
There is this idea in Hamlet that a ghost happens because the person who died is trapped in purgatory because of either something that happened in their life or how they died. Like there's a scene where Claudius is kneeling in prayer and Hamlet has the opportunity to sneak up on him and kill him, but he doesn't because he thinks, oh, if I kill him while he's in prayer, his soul will go to heaven while my father, his victim, is trapped in purgatory as a ghost. So I kind of like the idea that Wada is in purgatory because he can't reach out to his wife and daughter who are suffering, but on the other hand, he's not actually dead, and he does have the chance to have a hand in revenge. So maybe there's something to that, that he's the one who's a ghost.
Yeah, that is a great call.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I found it interesting that this movie, the father character, well, Von Hamlet is a father in the beginning, or is a father already dead? Oh, okay.
He's already dead. So Hamlet picks up, I think, a good chunk of time, maybe even up to a month or so, but maybe I'm exaggerating, after Claudius and Gertrude are married, and we're made to understand that they're married very, very quickly after old King Hamlet's death.
Mm-hmm.
So it hasn't been that long, but it's been a while. Old King Hamlet only ever appears as a ghost in the play, so there's been amount of time.
Yeah, it's interesting that they shifted the ghost from the father to a lesser character. Not lesser, but you know what I mean. It's like a different, non-familiar character.
Yeah. And of course, this story lacks the actual supernatural element that Hamlet has.
Personally, I wasn't too interested in supernatural stuff for the most part. Except for Rashomon.
Right.
I think
with
that's
the channeler, right?
Yeah. With the ghost or whatever. Yeah. And that's kind of it.
Yeah, and it seems like a lot of Japanese, at least the more famous Japanese cinema from this time period and before, was very focused on spirits and, you know, demons and stuff like that. So this is an extremely grounded, for the time period, movie. I mean, up to, and it feels like such a, I mean, we'll get into it later after the synopsis, but it feels like such a, like, hey, this is still going on and it sucks kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, we get a quick flash, surprisingly, since Nishi is kind of like our anti-hero, hero, whatever, in this movie, we don't really see much of him doing things other than, you know, quickly doing something to somebody to get a reaction out of them. We actually get to see him come home to his wife, who is, you know, Yoshiko is a very pleasant person.
Yeah, she's a good character.
And her brother is very protective and very worried and always very drunk.
Yeah.
Wants to make sure that Nishi is treating her right all the time, like she deserves the best.
And that when he reveals that he caused her accident in the first
place?
That
is correct. Yeah. This is the scene where feels like he should be, you know, he sees that Nishi and Yoshiko are sleeping in separate beds, and he just can't take it. He's like, no, my sister deserves the best, and it's all my fault that she's the way she is, so I'm counting on you, and I'm going to be watching you constantly. That's a lot of pressure. And it's all because of a bicycle accident, is that correct? Family is a big thing for the Iwabuchi clan, apparently. Brothers all about sisters, even their father is very doting on his daughter, his son, you know, is whatever. But there is also a scene very soon after this where we see old man Iwabuchi, who he's like barbecuing, basically. I mean, like a backyard barbecue.
Yeah.
And it's like this flash of normal family life. Like he opens up some foil that he had on the grill, and he's like feeding it to his daughter. You know, it's a touching scene.
Yeah, you see him as a human and not like a villainous 80s corporate villain.
Right. I keep forgetting his name. Iwabuchi gets a call saying that Shirai is waiting with Moriyama. at a certain location. They all meet up there, and Shirai is obviously ready to... He's already saying, like, you guys are trying to make me look crazy. I don't know what I did, but if anything happens to me, I'm going to tell everybody what's happening, which is when we get the setup for his assassination. Shirai gets home, walking through his dark street once again, and a man comes out of... Well, I think first he sees Wada again. He freaks out, and then a man comes out of the darkness and is like, are you Shirai? Huh? Are you him? Answer me? And then he's got a gun. But the assassination is stopped by an oncoming car that he gets into, driven by Nishi, who takes him to the building where he was aware a certain person jumped out of the 7th floor window. Did you guys think that it was like a huge reveal that it was his father who had been jumped out the window?
That's very hard to accurately gauge because I came on to this podcast to talk about this film's similarities to Hamlet, so I kind of knew the score going in. And I had to consult a Wikipedia page for the characters' names because, like I said, when they were speaking in the dialogue, it was often very hard to tell, like, names. So I knew going in, like,
understandable.
What the deal was. I don't know if I would have found it to be a big reveal or not. It was challenging for me to follow the film, honestly. I'm the sort of person who has to watch any film with subtitles multiple times. So then, on top of that, to have all the characters be wearing identical suits and sitting in boardrooms talking about business dealings made it additionally difficult for me to follow at times. So I don't know that I would have necessarily picked it up right away until he had announced it. I can't say.
I think the first time I saw this, I was surprised because I didn't know it was a Hamlet. That's actually
First he kind of holds him up to the window, and then he says it's poisoned, forces it down his throat, and it's not poison. So Nishi is hesitant to kill this person who he obviously has built up so much hate for. And we find out that... Well, I'm not sure if this is when we find out, but he's... He goes back to whatever place he's using as a hideout with Wada, and there's another man there who turns out to be he's the real Nishi, right?
Yeah.
He's somebody he used to work with. Who's the character in Hamlet that stands witness at the very end to... Okay, so I can see why they were pointing that, but... Yeah.
I can totally see it. Yeah, I think it's a strong possibility, but that's just like me reading Wada and Shirai as Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. There's not necessarily like a literal translation of one character over to the other, but I think there's a similar idea in how they serve the plot.
So after this, this was...
Well, okay. This is when Shirai is basically declared as being insane.
Yeah, and is this when the brother-in-law, the I guess the Laertes stand-in, is confronting his dad about not having Nishi do his all the dirty work, and then he's like, "What are you talking about?"
Well, let me see here. I did want to say that there's a part when Nishi is trying to convince Shirai to throw himself out the window, that he says, "You don't deserve the favor of an assassin's bullet," which I think is just, that's a really nice line. Mm-hmm.
It's a great noir.
Also, he's showing him this, like, photo, and he's like, this is Furuya's, Furuya, I guess, but where'd he get it from?
Stole it, probably.
He's got a lot of schemes going on.
He's got a lot of hands and a lot of hand places. Okay. So we do find out at this point why that Nishi is having a hard time going through with the murder. He's got less hate in his heart than he did before. And when he's talking to real Nishi about this, it turns out because he actually is in love with Yoshiko. and it's softening him. He doesn't want to ruin her life, but he also feels this dedication to his father figure. So there's that kind of mix-up going on there. I always got the feeling...
This is...
Yeah, I was going to say...
Very different from Hamlet. Hamlet uses Ophelia as a pawn in his plot, drives her to madness to the point where, depending on how you choose to interpret it, she either commits suicide or she's so mentally incapacitated that she's no longer capable of, like, safely caring for herself, and she accidentally drowns. But either way, like, he just bullies her to make other people think that he's crazy so that they won't suspect his plans. That is the poor thing's only role in his plot. So this was a huge diversion from Hamlet, and I'll admit for me a little bit of an unexpected one, because once I figured out that he had, you know, married his father's killers, in a way, killer's daughter, I assumed that he was only going to be using her for revenge purposes.
And I think that was his intention at first, too. But it feels kind of like one of those 1940s or 50s things where they do an adaptation of something. They're like, that's pretty sad. We should give him a happy ending. So in this version, Hamlet lives and him and Ophelia run off. So
40s and 50s, what about the 1990s Scarlet Letter that ends with Gary Oldman and Demi Moore running off together with their bastard child?
I mean, that's the way
child.
The book ended, right?
Yep, just like the original Scarlet Letter with all the Native American attacks, all those amazing action scenes. That the
yeah, and a new Gary Oldman.
Yeah, I was going to say, is there a part in the book where they painstakingly describe Gary Oldman's dingus? But probably not.
There's lots of bathing.
Yeah, thank you, Flophouse.
Yeah, hey, it's also a plot point in the film Easy A. Emma Stone even says in the narration for Easy A, she takes a lot of baths when talking about the Scarlet Letter movie from the 90s.
That's a good movie. Not the Scarlet. Basically, is laying out to the older Iwubacha, Bachi, that this keeps this seventh floor incident with the man committing suicide keeps getting referenced with the cake, with the photo, with Shirai losing his mind and saying that he wanted forgiveness for this act. So he decides to go all detective and see who could possibly want revenge for the suicide of that other person. So he ends up going to, what is it? Furuya's
widow.
Widow brings him a nice fruit basket.
Yeah, and there's this brings out a picture of who might be his bastard son.
Right.
Yep. And we see the fake Nishi, conspicuously in the background.
Yep.
He's very in focus.
Not trying to hide at all. He might as well have been wearing a sign that was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to get revenge because of this or something like that. But so Moriyama goes back to Iwubuchi and blabs about this situation. And Iwubuchi's son happens to overhear this. That's Tatsuo. And so he immediately gets a shotgun. When Nishi comes home, he's ready. He's gonna blow this guy away. He's so mad that he'd be using his sister, even though Tatsuo thinks that his father is kind of an evil person. But he won't have his sister disrespected. As we established earlier, he would do anything for his sister to make her happy.
Just like the 90s movie of Hamlet, where Ophelia and Laertes kiss on the lips for just a few seconds too long. That's really weird.
Is that the 2000s?
At this point, Nishi runs off, having, you know, the cats out of the bag. Poor Yoshiko is upset about this. Tetsuo doesn't shoot him. Iwabacha is like, oh crap, where's Maruyama? At some point, they kidnap Maruyama.
Yeah, they hold him hostage for a bit.
Yep, for a bit. This is the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
They are holding Maruyama in a bombed-out shelter at a place where a factory used to exist. It turns out this factory was a munitions factory that both Nishi and real Nishi worked at. Adakura, I believe, is the name that real Nishi is going by, but that's actually Toshiro Mifune's.
They switch identities. I don't even think
we mentioned that Toshiro Mifune is playing the main Nishi in this movie. You know, mainstay Kurosawa actor.
Yeah. Yeah, and, so they...
Mm-hmm.
You go.
Yeah. Okay, they're keeping Maruyama locked up until he tells them the location of the rest of the money and also the bank books that prove that this money was being embezzled. So their plan is coming to fruition. They're going to finally have enough evidence to show to the police. They're going to do a... You call a news conference, right?
Yeah, press conference.
Press conference, thank you. Press conference to announce that these people are lying liars who lie a lot. And
the vice president he asks his daughter where they are, and
first Wada decides that he doesn't want Yoshiko to have her life ultimately ruined, so. Mm-hmm. He goes and gets her, brings her to the bombed-out shelter. Nishi and Yoshiko have a heart-to-heart where he's basically, you know, he finally kisses her for the first time. There was a time earlier where they were about to kiss, and he hesitates because, you know, he is trying to use her just to get close to her father. But he really does love her. He says, when the plan is over, you know, I'm going to go to prison, but, he basically tells her that he loves her.
Yeah.
She goes back home, and Iwabuchi immediately kind of knows something's up because she never leaves the house. You know, the maid is, like, cleaning off her crutch, which he's probably never had seen her do before. And he says, "Oh my gosh, your brother left with a dressed as with a shotgun. I think he knows where Nishi is. I need to go help him out." And right before this scene happens, actually, Iwabuchi is on the phone with somebody and thanking them for sending over the drugs he needs in case he needs to commit suicide. So,
oh yeah.
This is just to show, we've seen other scenes where the people that they made the land development mm-hmm. deal with have been like, oh, you guys are screwing this up. But I think this is a scene where we actually see, you know, if he's the vice president, that means there must be a president somewhere. Yeah. I'm thinking that this is a, like, if you screw up this situation, I expect you to do the right thing.
You are not yeah. to be, that is the question.
What is that? Is that from Futurama?
Well, I mean, there's so many characters contemplating suicide in this movie, it's impossible not to bring up that line
absolutely.
Sooner or later. To sleep, perchance, to dream, and we have the title, The Bad Sleep Well.
Hmm.
So, perhaps some tie in there. There's another thing about the title that interested me. There's a famous line in Hamlet. Hamlet says to Rosencrantz, "For there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." So basically, talking about relativity, there's nothing really good or bad. It's how you perceive it.
Hmm.
So I thought that the use of the word bad, just like in the title, although I don't know that this is a film that necessarily extols moral relativity, except perhaps as it relates...
These people that are in power, they are bad, but they have their lives in such a way that they are successful, that they have peace of mind. Iwabuchi has this family that, you know, he's out there cooking for them, and I don't know. Anyway, this all winds up with the drug that was sent over for the vice president was some sort of sleeping medication. So he was going to use a small amount in order to go to sleep later, because he admits that he hasn't been sleeping well. And he tricks his daughter into drinking this concoction. And he gets her to tell her where Nishi is hiding. The next scene is kind of a victory scene back at the bunker there. By the way, we found out that when Nishi was talking to Yoshiko, that he didn't really know his father, that he knew his father as his uncle for the longest time.
Yeah.
And that when he found out that this person he'd known for so long was actually his father, he wanted nothing to do with him. And not too long before he killed himself, he tried to contact Nishi again. And Nishi wanted, once again, nothing to do with him. And then later found out that he had killed himself in this mysterious way. And that started everything. So he's already conflicted about his father, who he didn't really know, but he felt he had a duty to revenge upon, you know, these people that had caused him to kill himself.
Yes.
But we're seeing that things are kind of wrapping up here. Itakura and Nishi are planning to take the information that they now have. They've got they know where the money was buried, literally buried.
Yeah. Everything's going to plan.
They know where the bank book is. Then we go to a scene where Tatsuo returns home and finds Yoshiko asleep in her father's office, wakes her violently up, you know, because she's been drugged, so she doesn't wake up right away. And she admits that she thought that her brother was going to go kill Nishi, so she told Dad all about it. They drive over to the place where Nishi was hiding, and
on the way they see a horrific car crash.
Yep.
And then they're
just on the side of the road next to some train tracks.
Yeah, and the brother-in-law busts in, and it's revealed that
Itakura is like despondent. Looks like he's been roughed up. He doesn't look very good, and he says, he basically tells Yoshiko, "You told him, and now Nishi is dead." Now, the first time I watched this, I have to say I thought, oh, he's just saying that, you know, this is part of the plan or something like that, so he can disappear. Like, he's not really dead. He just set it up so that the papers are going to find out all about this bad stuff, and he's going to disappear into the ether or whatever. But no. Nishi was forcefully injected with
grain alcohol.
Grain alcohol, specifically, yeah. Then placed into a car and pushed in front of some tracks and smithereened by a train.
Yeah.
Creative.
And it's pretty terrible.
Yeah, it's a pretty harrowing end.
And basically that confirmed, you know, finally Tatsuo and Yoshiko confirm that their father is actually a pretty bad person. They go and confront him, and he at first is like, oh, wait, but he has to return to the phone call that he has to take care of. Business comes first, even at the end.
And he gets the end of the press conference where he's mourning the death of Nishi.
Yeah, he puts on his crocodile tears. Very No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. Mm. That's how it ends.
And then there's a musical number.
Yes. Yes, and there's a Bollywood-style musical number. The whole cast is perfectly synchronized.
It's pretty cool. Yep, all the dead people are alive again, and it's in color, and it's an explosion of joy.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's actually a very grim ending.
They come out and take a bow.
Yes.
So, yeah, what'd you guys think of this?
I liked it as, like, a, you know, a hard-boiled noir drama. I thought all the performances were really good. I especially enjoyed some of the character actors who were in it, but I thought the lead actor who played Nishi was also very charismatic. I think this type of movie is never going to be 100% my bag. Like I said, some of the business conspiracy stuff was really whooshing right over my head, and I tend to like movies that are maybe a little more character-driven than plot-driven, but it was really interestingly shot and overall fun to watch.
So you would probably like Ozu movies. His movies are more character-driven family dramas.
I'm sure I need to explore more foreign cinema. Like I said, it's just a matter of all have our areas of
I think it's very near to a masterpiece. I talked about that on the Yojimbo episode, what my opinion is. But I do think that the last third of it drags when they kidnap Moriyama and take him to that bunker. Because we do end up spending, you know, there's at least three or four scenes where we're down there waiting for Moriyama to break or talking about, you know, what our plans were. And I don't know if that's an aspect of, you know, obviously, once it's found out he's not really Nishi, it feels like we should be drawing to an end, or if it is just a problem with the script, or if it's just a problem with me. Which I always assume it is. But, this is definitely one of my favorite movies.
Kurosawa movies, you mean?
No, like, one of my favorite movies in general.
Oh.
Like, I really like the actors. Toshirô Mifune, as I've stated before, I'm not a gay man, but Toshirô Mifune, that's a handsome man.
You aren't the only one.
It's funny. He's like 40 in this movie. He's supposed to be playing younger, and like he doesn't look 40. He looks like a young man to me.
He definitely doesn't look 40. Yeah. I would say, it's still believable.
Yeah, it's neat. Sure. Neat. It's good seeing him in a role different, like a non like action lead role, because like the last few movies we saw of him were Seven Samurai and Yojimbo, where he's like a badass samurai. Mm-hmm. In this one, he's just like a very quiet, meek, like, I guess businessman, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, he's doing a completely different kind of acting, because in those movies, he's
over the top. He's got
he's doing deep in the throat thing, or, you know, like, ha ha ha, you guys are so stupid kind of thing. And this, he's very quiet.
He doesn't speak until
strategically saying things.
Yeah, I timed it. He doesn't speak until minute 33, second like 40.
Oh wow!
Yeah, he doesn't say a single word, and yet you can feel his presence the entire time.
Yeah.
Around 44 minutes in, the audio on Filmstruck came unsynced for whatever reason, so I had kind of like a singing in the no, 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 yes, 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 no, no situation, because it was during the scene where Yoshiko and her brother Tatsuya were talking to each other, and every time she opened her mouth, his voice would come out, and every time he opened his mouth, her voice would come out. And I eventually closed down my browser and researched, which fixed the problem, but it was a very amusing couple of minutes.
If I can find the old reviews of the movies, then I will read some of them, and there is a film critic for the New York Times from the era that me and Joel have encountered many times. The name Bosley Crowther, and Joel, do you want to know what he thought of this movie?
I'd be surprised if he was as down on it as he had been about the other things, but I mean, this guy he sucks. So let's hear what he had to say.
All right. I'll read the last paragraph of his review. So, Shannon, the thing with Bosley Crowther is he was the foreign film reviewer for New York Times in the 50s and 60s. And he does not like Japanese movies, really. He thinks they're mediocre or bad, generally, except for Rashomon and a few others. And he loves French movies.
Well, he's got the perfect name for a foreign film critic. Like, he has the name almost of a fictional character.
Bosley Crowther.
Yeah, I couldn't make that up in my wildest dreams. That's the perfect name for a snooty critic. Yeah.
So, Joel, he likes this movie.
Ooh, okay. I see. That's why I would think there was a chance that, because it takes place in a modern setting as opposed to the other ones.
Yeah. The last paragraph is review is, this is a powerful and interesting picture that Kurosawa has made. A bit tedious and mawkish in the last reels, but exciting enough along the way to satisfy audiences that know the subject. The English subtitles are poor.
This is true. There were moments when characters would say, like, you guys, in the middle of a formal business meeting.
Yeah, like, even though he really likes it, he has to point out something bad about it.
Yeah, well.
But, yeah,
he's a critic.
I mean, I think he may have had a point about the English subtitles, which is not a mark. I wouldn't consider that a mark against the film. I would consider that a mark against whoever was in charge of doing the translation. But there were moments where the translation got weirdly informal in a way that felt
very if the translation isn't the best compared to the other ones we've seen.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It didn't take away from my personal enjoyment, though. So, nerds to you.
Well, he's been dead for a while.
He's been haunting the newspaper. Stuck in purgatory.
Yeah, so I do really not really like this. This is from like mid-tier Kurosawa. It's not like for me like when I have to rewatch, because I like I don't know. It's well done and everything. It's just kind of, I've had this problem with his other play adaptations where it's an adaptation and it doesn't feel like 100% him. Like I can feel the Shakespeare-ness in parts.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And it's kind of like what I had with the problem I had with like The Men Who Tread on Tiger's Tales, where like it doesn't feel like he's trying, doesn't feel like he's just going full Kurosawa and doing like the, it doesn't feel like him throughout the whole film, which is kind of, it's still very good. It's just, for me, not one that I would consider to be one of my favorites, but still, you know, it's worth watching.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that, I think we would all say that people should watch this movie.
Yeah. And, Yeah, and it has, does the standard symmetrical Kurosawa shot a bunch of times, and that's every time that always gets me. It's just, it's great.
I say that the music was also really well done in this movie. The score, that is. Your opinion is void if you disagree with me. Anyways, let's start wrapping up. I'm afraid poor Shannon is going to be suffering.
I'm sorry, you guys. I get up really early for work, so.
To go through like other movies that came out the same year, doesn't matter from where from what country or anything, that's the same year that you really like or think are notable.
Wait, did you tell her about this before we started recording?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
I went and looked up all the films that came out in 1960. And I was not impressed. You have Psycho, which I'm not going to recommend because everyone has seen it. You have The Apartment, which I'm not going to recommend because everyone has seen it. And then you have two movies that I watched as a very small child, The Swiss Family Robinson and Pollyanna, neither of which I will recommend. So I was like, what the fuck? I did nothing. God damn it. I'm not going to recommend Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. Like, fuck that noise. If anyone is listening to this podcast, probably, they've seen Psycho. So I went and looked up what was on Broadway that year. Because I decided, oh, I will recommend a play instead, since I was brought on for my theatrical expertise instead of my film expertise in the first place. And as luck would have it, on Broadway in 1960, there was another Shakespeare modernization.
Yeah.
West Side Story was on Broadway in 1960, which is a wonderful modernization of Romeo and Juliet. The book, which is the word we use in the theater for the dialogue portion of a musical, the book isn't the most sparkling, witty dialogue of all time, nor is it the most original story that's ever been told, because, let's face it,
just with Puerto Ricans and white people.
But the choreography really changed the American musical theater world forever. And in recent years, revivals of West Side Story have made a huge effort to be a lot more culturally sensitive. Like, for example, the song America is usually done completely in Spanish now. There are productions that do all of the shark scenes in Spanish. And definitely casting has made an effort to be more culturally correct. So I would say, see a modern production of West Side Story if you can. The choreography totally holds up. It's amazing. And even though the movie West Side Story wouldn't come out till several years after 1960, it's really beautiful to watch. It has a lot of incredible song and dance scenes. So, well, I would say it's probably one of the greatest movie musicals of all time, just in terms of, like, the way the numbers are shot is very, very exciting, and the choreography itself is very exciting. So I would say that's almost a movie where if you were to skip around to the songs and fast forward to the dialogue scenes, I wouldn't even be mad at you, because it's literally just the plot of Romeo and Juliet transposed to 1950s gang warfare. But I'm going to stand by that recommendation. It's a very entertaining
movie. And Joel, you and me will pick our picks for next episode.
Okay, I've got some good ones, so.
Yeah, me too.
Sure, well, The Bad Sleep Well was so good. If you want to listen to a podcast about something that's terrible, try Stage of Fools, which is the podcast that I do with my co-host Zach Powers. The E! Television Network, which is mostly known for, like, Keeping Up with the Kardashians and other reality shows of a similar ilk, decided that its first foray into scripted television should be a drama that was an attempted modernization of Hamlet. So week by week, we start every episode with a little Shakespeare performance, because every episode of this dumb show has a Shakespeare quote as its title. And then we kind of just talk about it and riff on it and expound on all the crazy stuff that happens. So, yeah, check us out. Stage of Fools. We're on iTunes and Facebook, or you could tweet at us.
It's a very good podcast. It's a very good podcast. I listen to it.
Well, I appreciate it. We have a lot of fun. there's been some behind-the-scenes drama over the years, shall we say. But I won't tell tales out of school.
Joel, I recommend it.
All right, I will give it a listen. Definitely.
I've
heard Shannon on plenty of other podcasts, and I think that she's always entertaining.
Yeah.
Thank you. I got to make a returning guest joke the other night. So I'm living the high life.
I have really started watching The Royals. Almost.
Oh, I. Here's the thing: when it's crazy, it's like the best thing ever, and when it gets really boring and serious, it makes me want to throw my computer out the window. So
hearing you and Zach complain about the bad episodes makes it seem like maybe I'm doing the right thing and not watch it.
Well, I will say, if anyone wants to dive into the podcast, I would say listen to season one and then just go ahead and listen to season three, because season two was such a slog of a season of the show that Zach and I really struggled to talk about it. But the good news is that our most recent season, season three, has been so balls to the wall bananas, like people sleeping with their own body doubles and stuff, and just a lot of weird sexual stuff, like adult babies and stuff. We've had a lot to talk about. And I usually get really quiet when we get to the weird sex stuff because I want to force Zach to talk about it on air, because I know that it makes him more uncomfortable than it makes me. So I want to hear him talk about it.
Yeah. J-Dog, you got a podcast?
Yeah, my weekly science fiction and fantasy movie podcast, Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, still going strong. Not really much to say about it. Check us out, facebook.com/PDSMIOS. Me and my co-hosts Aaron and Sarah just talk about a different movie each week. You know, things as popular as Jurassic Park and as obscure as...
Stalker, your favorite movie.
I mean, that's an art movie.
You love the movie Stalker.
That's actually our most listened to episode.
If you want to hear me and Joel discuss another old Japanese movie, listen to the Please Don't Send Me an Outer Space episode on Face of Another.
The Face of Another.
Episode 48, I think.
Ooh. Yep.
49.
Really good movie.
Yeah.
I don't know about the episode, but the movie's good.
Check out both. And
just watch me.
Fine.
Just try me.
Let's see. I have other stuff. Okay, I write for a website, Cinema Knife Fight. I review old TV shows, old horror science fiction stuff. This will be coming out later this month, in February. And the review for this month is Misfits of Science. It's a show from her mid-80s. It's Courtney Cox's first starring role in anything, where she's basically the Fantastic Four, the TV show, but not the Fantastic Four. And she has psychic powers, and the guy who played the Predator in the Predator movies is can shrink himself, and there's an electric guy, and there's a guy who can just... who's just a scientist. It's a fun little show. So I review that for February, and check out Cinema Knife Fight. It's a quality website with great writers on it. Yep.
Great name, too.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Let's see. Next episode will be the second half of the 1960 pairing. So we got Jigoku, a.k.a. The Sinners from Hell, with Gina Radcliffe from Kill la Kill.
Oh, she's in that movie?
Oh, I know.
She's the best. I just groaned involuntarily because of how much I love her. Gina, if you're listening, I miss you now that you're on Facebook hiatus. But she's a great podcaster. I love Kill la Kill. So
yeah, me and Gina have a vague podcast that might come out at some point in the future. I don't know. It might come out. Yeah. Alright.
Alrighty. Well, you've tantalized.
Alright, so there's an email. I forget. Alright. Alfie Design, #ThugLife.
Yes, thank you for listening.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I hope that if you need to shave down anything, I definitely won't be offended. I know some of those tangents were tangents.
And we're going to cut out all of our audio and leave just yours, actually.
Yeah.
Just to cut down the whole podcast to a trim 15 minutes.
We're just like Darren.
Get in, get out.
Thank you for being on.
Yeah, no, Darren hates... Okay, real quick before I go, though. Darren hates editing stuff out. Every week I tell him, I'm like... please edit out Zach and I arguing with each other about the fucked up timeline of the royals. And he's like, okay. And then I go and listen to the episode and it's all there.
He's a very busy person.
All right. Yeah, no, he does an amazing job. Like, this season he's even been dropping in, like, music cues and clips of dialogue from the show. He likes the details.
This place is weird.
He doesn't want to edit them out.
Understandable. So
it's a matter of
without the catchphrase from the series, this place is weird from the season. The failed catchphrase.
Yeah, it is. Oh, God. There are so many failed catchphrases. Well,
yes.
Again, another conversation for another day and another podcast, which I host. Just let me know where I should send my audio track.
Will do.
All right.
Thank you so much for being on.
Have a great night.
Yeah, bye.
Oh, thank you. Bye.